Good afternoon. We have one case, third case today. 2011-AP-2956 CR State versus Gary Monroe. Is it Skull? And representing Mr. Skull is Basil M. Loeb. You have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. And Ms. Noah, Assistant Attorney General representing the state, you've got 30 minutes. Counsel, you may proceed.
First, I want to thank everybody for the opportunity to speak here today, not just on behalf of Mr. Skull, but on behalf of the State Public Defender's Office, on behalf of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. It's a unique situation for me to be in, as ordinarily I'm only advocating for my particular client. In this particular circumstance, I think I'm advocating for the Public Defender's Office as well and the Association of Defense Attorneys. I thank them for their briefs. I think their briefs have added a lot to the record in this case, certainly provided a lot of background to the history of the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule and the two different prongs of the good faith exception, which I'll get into down the road here. I want to start by highlighting what I think are the three particular and undisputed facts in this case. We have an underlying search that's unconstitutional. We have an underlying search that is not valid under any binding precedent in the state of Wisconsin at the time the underlying search was performed in 2010. And we have a search warrant in this case that's acted on by officers that is based, at least in part, and my argument is based primarily on the underlying search, which is an unconstitutional search. Those are the three basic facts that we have today. I don't think the state can reasonably oppose any of those three facts. And those three particular facts are exactly the facts of the Florida versus Jardines United
States. Counselor, I'm going to attack you right away on one of your facts. You say the warrant is based primarily on the underlying unconstitutional search, and I assume you're talking about the dog sniff there.
Yes.
There were a variety of other things that were in the warrant. Now, in the affidavit that supported the warrant, they got a lot of information from a confidential informant that they knew to be reliable, correct? They had past dealings with this person?
They did, but the CI noted that the drug activity was coming from Mr. Skull's vehicle.
Right.
Nothing from the CI was connecting the drugs itself to Mr. Skull's home.
Well, but they connected Mr. Skull with the address, and the address was then verified through other means. He personally witnessed Mr. Skull in the distribution of drugs at various locations in Milwaukee. He conducted narcotics trafficking from his vehicle. They gave a description of the vehicle, description of the license plate. And as I said, they were familiar with the CI's knowledge of cocaine base and its distribution in Milwaukee. So those are a lot of facts that were corroborated. The only thing in the affidavit that comes from the dog sniff is that the dog alerted on the residence, the front door of the residence, right?
That would be correct, but the confidential informant did not specify exactly when he had witnessed the alleged drug transactions. The CI did not specify to whom Mr. Skull had been dealing these drugs to. The CI did not identify what particular drugs were being transacted. We don't have the specific locations of where these drug transactions took place. And nothing from the CI, other than saying it's Mr. Skull and this is his vehicle, says that Mr. Skull has drugs in his residence.
Nice.
And if the CI information was good enough, then the police would never have gone to the house to do the dog sniff in the first place. They simply would have gotten a warrant based upon what the CI said.
I think sometimes they like to wear a belt and suspenders, and sometimes it tends to get them into difficulties. You know, at the time this dog sniff was conducted, it was 2010, right?
Correct.
In 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court said a dog sniff of a luggage in place was not a search forget whether it's constitutional or not, it was not a search, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
In an airport, which is a public place where nobody would have a realistic expectation of privacy as opposed to a person's home like Mr. Skull in this case.
Well, to me, there are two parts to this, though I agree with you that in Jardine, the court doesn't seem to separate them out at all. But initially, the decision was made in Place and also Cavella's that a dog sniff was not a search. And, in fact, we made the same decision in Arias, but just under the Wisconsin Constitution previously, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So the sands shift when Jardine comes down because it says not only is the dog sniff a search, but when you do it in someone's or in the protected area of someone's home, it's an unconstitutional search, right?
Correct.
Okay. So there were two parts to that. And I guess I'd like you to address for me why we can approach it two ways. First of all, I started off by trying to get you to say what you thought was really necessary to have probable cause to support the warrant. And it's your view there's not probable cause without the dog sniff. And I get that.
Not probable cause to search his house. I think there would be some probable cause to potentially search his vehicle or follow Skull, which the police didn't either of.
Right, right. And the warrant was broad. I agree. So we're worried about the drugs came out of the house, so that's what you're looking at suppressing. I get that. Okay, there are a number of approaches to what you do when you end up having some activity by the police that is held to be unlawful, and that conclusion came about after the activity occurred. Some cases say you reach through the warrant, you look at it, if that's bad, the warrant's bad. Other cases say no, if they didn't have a reasonable belief that what they were doing was unconstitutional based on precedent, then it's not bad. You want to tell me what your approach would be to those approaches?
Right. Well, my difficulty there is the truncated nature of the motion hearing before the trial court, where the officer who applied for the search warrant did not even testify. And the circuit court, I believe, said that they had to leave early and that they only gave the parties about 20 minutes for an actual hearing. The only officer that testified is the one that did the actual dog sniff. So there wasn't a great record developed with respect to the underlying police investigation into Mr. Skull, other than the dog sniff, which has been ruled to be illegal. And I did mention that in my reply brief. If this court's inclined to, you know, affirm what the Court of Appeals did, I think this court should consider a remand to the trial court so we can hear from the officer who signed the search warrant affidavit and who interviewed the CI to get a better understanding as to the basis for the search warrant and the investigation the police did at the time.
If you're focusing on whether there was probable cause to issue the warrant, and I might agree with that approach. But if you're looking at it as a question of law and the argument is made that the dog sniff search, which is the first search, was unconstitutional and the warrant relied on that in a way that without it there wouldn't have been probable cause, I think there are still two approaches as a matter of law that have been taken by various federal district courts. And the phrase I hear repeating of those cases that will sustain the warrant is that the action that is now determined to be illegal was close enough to the line of validity at the time it occurred that the court should permit the warrant to stand and the officer to reasonably rely on it. Do you know the line of cases that I'm talking about? McCain is one of them, and there are a number of cases that use that phrase. Are you familiar with that?
I am, but I'm arguing that those don't apply because we have a clear rule from Jardine's, and we have the exact same fact scenario that the state of Florida had. And in that situation, the state of Florida trial court granted a motion to suppress. It goes to the Florida Supreme Court. The Florida Supreme Court essentially affirms the motion to suppress, and it goes up to the United States Supreme Court, who's saying that this type of behavior is illegal, it's a Fourth Amendment violation, and we're going to uphold a motion to suppress order by a trial court. So I think this court and the Court of Appeals has to follow Jardine's. I think the rule in Jardine's is that the dog sniff is unreasonable. The dog sniff unreasonableness must be applied retroactively, and the dog sniff invalidates the search warrant. And the remedy is the, and I really think the issue here is the remedy the Court of Appeals didn't order from Mr. Stowe. The remedy is suppression of the evidence because the United States Supreme Court in Jardines concluded that the remedy in that case was suppression of the evidence. And that, those facts are the same as the facts here.
Mr. Loeb, why doesn't the case of Eason and the good faith exception apply in your opinion here?
In my opinion, those, the Eason and United States versus Leon, which hold that if the police are reasonably relying on a search warrant that's later ruled to be unconstitutional, then the good faith exception applies and the evidence is not suppressed. The difference here is that the error making the search in those two cases unconstitutional was an error by a neutral magistrate whose job it was to determine whether a search warrant affidavit contained probable cause or reasonable suspicion. And in those two particular cases, the police did not do anything wrong. In Skull and in Jardines, the police did something that was concluded to be wrong. In Skull and Jardines, it's the police act that causes the constitutional violation. In Leon and Eason, it's the magistrate's act that caused the constitutional violation.
Don't you take into account Arias as well in looking at whether or not Eason and Leon should apply?
I don't, because I think the focus there is, especially with Leon, and you know, remember again that the United States Supreme Court failed to apply the good faith exception in Jardines. I think that should carry a lot of weight, because they're the court that created the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. Their rationale in United States versus Leon is that if it's not going to deter future police conduct, then there's no sense in suppressing the evidence. If a warrant is invalid because a magistrate makes a mistake, suppressing that evidence isn't going to punish the police, isn't going to deter the police, and it's not going to deter the magistrate at all. In Jardines and in the Skull case, suppressing the evidence would further the purpose of the exclusionary rule, which is to deter police conduct so that the police don't do something like this in the future.
Well, the police, how would the police know that a dog sniff was unconstitutional when this court and the U.S. Supreme Court had said the dog sniff is not even a search? They said it wasn't even a search. So how do they have a clear rule, and you're deterring now police conduct if you don't apply the good faith rule? How was there a clear rule? The search was not even, I mean, a dog sniff was not even a search, let alone unconstitutional.
That's my point. You're putting it a lot on the police officers to make their own legal analysis as to whether their conduct is going to be ruled valid or not down the road. Those other dog cases have to do with automobiles. They have to do with public places. Nothing at all in the state of Wisconsin or the United States Supreme Court in 2010 dealt with a dog sniff at a private residence.
I don't disagree with that. But, you know, when the police officers look at the precedent that comes down out of this court and it says a dog sniff is not a search, we don't expect them to go through an analysis to say a dog sniff, I mean, if it had said it was just not unconstitutional but was a search, that would be one thing. To say that it's not a search is quite different, because what happens is you never get to worrying about whether it's constitutional. So I really see quite a big difference in what's going on in Jardine and what's going on here.
Respectfully, I don't, because it's the same. It's the same case. In Jardines, a confidential informant said Jardines is dealing drugs, and that informant identified the drugs in Jardines' house. So it even had a greater connection of the drugs to Jardines' house as opposed to the information from the confidential informant merely said Skull is dealing drugs from his vehicle. And I would like to point out that the vehicle was never searched. The police could have brought a drug-sniffing dog to sniff his vehicle, which would have aided the probable cause aspect of this case at all. And they didn't do that. And the police didn't just go to Skull's house once. They went twice. On the first time,
well, they left because there were people around.
People around.
And they didn't want to cause a problem.
If the police really think they're acting appropriately, they're not going to be that secretive, and they're not going to come back at a point in time where they don't want to be seen. Plus, the officer at the motion hearing in the trial court confirmed that he didn't want anybody to see him.
So it seems to me that Justice Roland Sack is asking, and if not, I'll ask,
that both in Jardine and here, there was case law, right, from the U.S. Supreme Court, that a dog sniff is not a search, right?
I would agree, but those cases focused on dog sniffs of
I know,
at an airport and of vehicles.
Does that mean that there is, one of your points is that there's no precedent
in Wisconsin?
Well, but Justice Rogenczyk is saying is there is precedent. The precedent is that the dog sniff is not a search. If it's not a search, how can it be illegal? That was the precedent. Now, is that claimed by the state?
And I think the line of cases hold that a dog sniff of a vehicle is not a search, and a dog sniff at an airport of someone's luggage at an airport is not a search because a person in an airport does not have a legitimate expectation of privacy. I think it's unreasonable to extend that rule to a person's home where their Fourth Amendment rights are.
That's your answer.
Paramount.
Your answer is that under those circumstances, it's not a search.
Correct.
And but that you don't have a case that says a dog sniff at a home is not a search.
Right. And, I mean, this is why this case has been on appeal for 3 or 4 years, because the Court of Appeals waited for the U.S. Supreme Court to issue its decision. If the Jardines case wasn't important to their analysis because there was this past precedent, then they would have made a decision without the benefit of the Jardines decision.
And the best that the state can do is say that at the time of Jardine, it was a strong indication that the sniff was okay, but clear.
Binding appellate precedent.
Yeah. And that's your point, isn't it?
Absolutely. Not just from U.S. versus Davis and this court's own rule in State versus Dearborn. Binding appellate precedent in the state of Wisconsin. There was absolutely none in effect at the time of the dog sniff at the residence in 2010. I think a lot of weight has to be given on the fact that it's of Mr. Skull's residence as opposed to a vehicle or in some type of public place.
So the state's wanting a rule that extends Dearborn.
I would say to extend U.S. versus Davis and Dearborn to persuasive authority, based upon some, cases that are analogies.
The state wants the police officer to check out the 50 states in the federal system, the federal courts of appeal or federal district courts, to decide whether there's persuasive authority that a dog sniff at a residence is or is not valid.
Correct, and I think that's placing too much work on the police officers, and I think there needs to be a clear, bright rule governing their activity, and if it's an area of the law that's unsettled or where there's maybe persuasive authority for their act, then if they're going to go ahead and take the risk of doing that act and it's later ruled to be unconstitutional, then the police need to be punished. I'm not saying the police can't do that, but they should be punished if the act they end up doing is unconstitutional.
Why should the... I just don't believe in this punishment argument. And I know that it's used in the Dearborn. I know it was used in U.S. Supreme Court cases occasionally. But you also have justices saying, hey, it's not punishing the police. The police did as good a job as they could, but it's not valid. And if it's not valid, then it's suppressed. Is the exclusionary rule a constitutional rule, or is it a prudential rule?
Oh, it's a constitutional rule as the remedy if there's a Fourth Amendment violation, and unless it falls within some type of exception, it should be followed. In my opinion, in this case, and perhaps punishment for the police officers isn't the right word, deterrence. If you're going to go ahead and
do this... That's a good word.
If you're going to go ahead and do this when the law is unsettled and there's no binding precedent in the state of Wisconsin that's required by Dearborn, you can go ahead and do this act and do this search, but if it's later ruled to be unconstitutional, we're going to exclude that evidence to deter you from doing that act or acting like that in the future. I agree. I think deterrence is a better word than to punish the officers. And, I also think a Fourth Amendment violation needs to have teeth, and I think the Court of Appeals minimized the Fourth Amendment violation in this case by not excluding the evidence.
So what's wrong with just moving the ball a little bit? We have Dearborn that required clear and binding precedent. And now here we have a situation where there is no case on point. There is no binding precedent. But the law develops incrementally. Why isn't that just an incremental movement on the doctrine of good faith?
Well, because in this situation, there is a clear difference between the binding precedent that the state wants to focus on, which are, you know, these dog sniffs are not searches, the dog sniff at the airport in the Place case is not a search, to a search at somebody's residence. And I go back to the information that the police had from this confidential informant that didn't connect anything to Mr. Skull's residence. And I think that individuals' protections in their own homes are so paramount that we can't just extend Dearborn and Davis and say that it's okay for the police to have some type of persuasive authority here. There needs to be a specific case on point, either prohibiting the conduct or authorizing the conduct before they're able to act without consequence. And I think the point I'm trying to make, and the point I think the Public Defender's Office is trying to make, is that, you know, there's not a problem with the police doing this. The problem is if the police do this and it's ruled to be unconstitutional, there needs to be a deterrent to the police for doing this, and there needs to be suppression of that evidence.
What's the binding precedent that you rely on to say that a dog sniff of a residence is, number one, a search, and number two, unconstitutional? And you can just answer the first part, because the second part I don't think we're really arguing about.
Right. Well, the Jardines case concludes that. Bringing a drug-sniffing dog to a residence without a warrant.
But we're talking about in 2010 when this search occurred. We're talking about in 2010, and you were saying they shouldn't do this unless there's binding precedent. Well, what is the binding precedent in 2010 that said a dog sniff was a search?
Well, there was none in Wisconsin.
And there was none in the U.S. Supreme Court either.
Right. And my point was...
In fact, they said the opposite. It was not a search.
Right. And my point was that it wasn't a situation... I'm saying if the police want to do something when there's no... It's unsettled law or there's no clear binding precedent, then...
Yeah, see, my problem is I try to look at this from the defendant's standpoint and from the actors as they move through the courts to get to us. And the officer on the beat, if he's instructed as they try to keep people up to date, he's going to know that a dog sniff is not a search. And I agree with you that there was no precedent that said a dog sniff at a residence wasn't a search. But I'm not sure that that's going to become apparent to a police officer on the beat who thinks a dog sniff isn't a search. What's the difference where I do it?
Exactly. You're placing too much burden on the police officer to then do their own analysis. And if their analysis is wrong...
Okay. We are talking past each other, but that's okay. I'll let my colleagues ask a question.
Sure.
The binding precedent on the police officers, if I understand your argument, at the time of this search was that a dog sniff at a luggage rack transportation was not a search.
Maybe, again, we don't really know because the record wasn't developed at the trial court.
No,
to get
but
an idea of what the officers knew.
That's the case law, wasn't it?
Yes.
And an officer who's been trained on the case law would know that a dog sniff at a car was not a search, right?
Correct.
So a careful analysis and a careful training of the police officer would have binding precedent on those two matters, right?
I agree.
Well, I'm trying to make your argument if I understand it. And then there was no precedent, no binding precedent for the police officer to say a dog sniff on the front porch is not a search. There was no case on that.
Correct.
No statute on that.
Correct.
Right. No regulation on that. So the careful police officer, carefully trained, wasn't told that that's binding precedent. That was an open issue.
I agree.
All right. Since it was an open issue, then you're arguing that it doesn't fall under Dearborn, which court carefully said that you needed a clear provision on precedent.
Same with United States versus Davis, which I think held the
same.
That's
right. I got Davis here, too, and Davis says the same thing. And in one of these cases, or maybe it's in the Jardine case, the court says, or maybe it's in the Davis case, it is not deciding an issue of where there is no clear binding precedent. It's deciding only where there is clear binding precedent.
Right.
So this is an open question in this case.
I agree.
Right.
And I think I'm out of time.
But could I ask?
Justice Prosser.
Is there such a thing as a police officer sniff? I mean, could the police officer walk up to the door, and if the officer detected the odor of marijuana or something, that be used for a search warrant?
I think it would be.
Mm-hmm. It's called the plain sniff rule.
Yeah, even
in the gymnasium. Full court.
So, do I understand that the police officer and the dog went up to the door, the front door?
Front door, yes.
Did they go to the side door, too?
I'm not sure. I know he went on a couple of occasions. On the second occasion, I know the sniff was at the front door, and they were there around 20 seconds, according to his testimony.
Okay. Now, as an old politician, I used to go to a lot of doors. Sometimes people had a back stairway to the second floor, and I was climbing up that stairway to knock on the door. This is an obvious violation of the property rights of the defendant when the police officer went to the front door with a dog.
I think when he went to the front door with the dog, with the only intention to do a search by having the dog do the sniff. He wasn't there to knock on the door or to say hi or to investigate anything like the State versus Edgeberg case. And as what's undisputed in his testimony, he didn't want anybody to see him. So any ordinary person, if they saw someone bring a dog to the residence, would think that person is coming and committing a trespass on me. And my understanding of the rule in Jardines is that bringing the drug-sniffing dog to a residence without a warrant for the sole purpose of conducting a search is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So I think that's what Jardine says, and I think that's what happened here.
So the officer couldn't go alone to see if he or she could smell something?
I don't believe so, if their sole purpose was just to conduct a search, no.
Hear something? To hear something?
No, if their sole purpose was just to smell or to do that, I don't think that would be legitimate. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelsey. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Nowak?
I think, Justice Abrahamson, you got to the point where you referenced, and I believe correctly so, Davis, and it was Justice Sotomayor's concurrence in which she pointed out that we are dealing here with a case where there is clear binding precedent, a case on all fours, so to speak, and not necessarily one where it's more unsettled. And so that's the question we have to deal with here, because arguably we're a bit more unsettled. I disagree with the defense in terms of his statement that there was absolutely no binding precedent. I think Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court was clear. Dog sniffs weren't searches. Arias by this court was clear, albeit in the context of a dog sniff of a car. Miller, a court of appeals decision preceding Arias, is even a little bit more specific. And in Miller, and I'm looking specifically at paragraph 9, and the cite to that is 256 with second 80. I'm looking at paragraph 9. We conclude that under the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment, dog sniffs are not searches, period. There's no limitation to cars.
Well, we're not always right either.
No, they're not, but we're talking about what the law was and a published decision at the time that the police officers did what they did in this case. That paragraph continues. Although Place's actual holding specifically addressed only sniffs of luggage in an airport, the logic of Place that dog sniffs reveal only illegal conduct, so they intrude on no legitimate privacy interest, would apply equally in any setting. Footnote. At least one federal court has concluded that despite United States versus Place and United States versus Jacobson, dog sniffs are searches when they are performed outside a home because there is a greater expectation of privacy in homes, citing United States versus Thomas. Another district court concluded without addressing Place that a canine sniff of a person was a search, citing United States versus Kelly. But these conclusions are questionable given Place's broad rationale. Further, neither Place nor Jacobson suggested that the object-subject search was an important or even relevant consideration in determining whether a dog sniff is a search. That was published law when this dog sniff took place, along with Arias and other United States Supreme Court precedent that we've already touched on. And so I think the question becomes, this isn't bowling, you know, to take an example from the OWI context, and I know this court has very recently heard argument on it. This isn't bowling. Did we have a case in Wisconsin that said it's okay for a police officer to take a drug-sniffing dog to someone's front door and that's not unconstitutional? No, we didn't. I think Miller comes close. But did we have that? Did we have a bowling, or do we have a bowling situation here? No. That said, are we really going to suggest that police officers are never permitted to rely in any way, shape, or form on the state of the law? We expect them to know what the law is. Generally speaking, do we expect complicated legal analyses? No. But at some point, we hold them to know what the law is. And I'd like to get back to a point Justice Crooks brought up earlier about whether this is an Eason-type situation. I think in very many ways it is. And also, of course, the question, as I brought up when I first began my remarks, is what do we do when we don't have bowling? And the United States Supreme Court then says, look, here's a rule, and now you have an invalid search, as we do in this case, the dog sniff. What do you do? Is there an objective test that you could put in place that would work? And it's my position that you can. The resounding theme, and counsel acknowledged this, is deterrence. We want to deter future Fourth Amendment violations. And how do we do that? And the good faith exception is very much about that. Police misconduct. Was the magistrate misled? Did the officer know or have reason to know that what he or she was doing was illegal? And I submit that that should be part of the standard here.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court in other cases has said that obviously if the police officer's conduct is egregious or fraudulent or use a whole group of words, then you should suppress. If we take your standard, what's left to the exclusion other than the egregious conduct of a police officer?
Are you speaking just to police officers' conduct?
Mm-hmm.
And again, there I would make the standard. Did the officer know, or should he or she have known.
Is that objective or subjective?
I think that's an objective test.
So you want the court to have say, should the officer have known?
Did the officer know or should the officer have known that his or her conduct was unlawful?
Now, do we know in this case, on the basis of this record, can we reach that conclusion?
I think given the state of the law at that time, Miller and Arias, specific to Wisconsin, the United States Supreme Court decisions in Cabalas Place, I think the answer to that question is no. The officer was not on notice, did not know, and should not have known that going up to the door. I think we all agree, even after Jardines, by the way, and Justice Prosser sort of touched on this a little bit with counsel, an officer can still walk up to someone's door. Hey, can I talk to you? By the way, I'm just wondering, are you dealing drugs? Practical example? No. But it's allowed. It's permissible. And it's the state's position that before Jardines was decided, there was no reason for the officer to think he couldn't take a dog with him when he did that.
What about this? I think most of us in fifth grade, by that time, know the maxim, your home is your castle, right? There's something special about the home. Now, I wouldn't be able to have attributed that to a Fourth Amendment, but you know there's something special about the house. And in the context of Fourth Amendment, there has always been something special about the house and the curtilage. So don't you think the officer can be held to know that?
I think at the time this happened, sure. I mean, the house, you're right. The house is special. It's sacrosanct in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. And yet, what was the state of the law at the time? And by the way, I have more to add to my standard on the objective reasonableness here. Hedgehog, Cabalas, Place, Miller, Arias, I don't think the officer was in a position to know or should have known that he couldn't do what he did.
Hmm. Could be. I mean, I don't know the answer to the inquiry exactly, but I do know the excellent educational offerings that law enforcement gets on occasion, and I could envision in those presentations that there is a distinction between house and vehicle. And there seems to be in a lot of our law distinctions between expectations of privacy and house and vehicle.
Well, there are distinctions, but again, circling back here, let's not forget there's more. And by more, I mean this. This is not just an officer deciding to do this and then blowing into the house. Also in the cases that discuss the good faith exception in this context or similar ones, the overriding theme, of course, is deterrence. We want to avoid police misconduct in the future. But another theme, and this comes right from Leon, there are the four factors, but really all four address one or either of two things: misconduct, misrepresentation, something wrong on the part of the police officers, and then there are errors that the magistrate commits sometimes, and we don't want to punish the police necessarily for the magistrate's error and that kind of thing, but there's more in the process. So the officers here, let's just assume for argument's sake, at least they're not on notice that what they're doing is wrong, but there's more to this process. They make full disclosure, and I would submit that that would be another part of the standard I would encourage the court to adopt today. Not only do you have to have a police officer who takes action without knowledge or in a position where he can't know that what he's doing is unlawful, you have full disclosure of what the officer did, both to the reviewing officer and or reviewing governmental attorney as provided by Eason, and then subsequently to a neutral, detached magistrate who finally signs off on the warrant. So there's more to the process. This isn't just what the police officer decides is okay at the time. I mean, I think we all want the police to follow the law. Do we expect them to make an elaborate legal analysis? No. But at some point, if they're not on notice that what they're doing is wrong, that's where we start. And then it filters through the rest of the process, doesn't it? And the police officer, a great example, I think, is a case the Court of Appeals decided September 30th, Officers went to a trailer, a confidential informant. The case, by the way, is State v. Jeremiah Popp and State v. Christopher Thomas. It was a consolidated appeal. The appeal numbers are 2013 AP 1916 CR and 2014 AP 166 CR. Officers get a tip, an anonymous tip from an informant that couldn't, I think, by any stretch of the imagination be deemed reliable. But go to a trailer park, having deciphered which trailer it is that the CI was talking about. There they meet the, I don't know if he owned it or was a tenant, I don't think it matters, one of the named defendants who came out and spoke with them. And after learning they were police officers and being asked for consent to search his trailer, said no. At that point, from what I read in the recitation of facts, officers kind of crawled all over the trailer, peering in windows, putting their faces up against it, several different parts of the trailer, looking inside and gathering additional information that they then used as the basis for a warrant. I don't think anybody in this room would sit and look, review that set of facts and say that's okay.
It looks like community caretaker to me.
And I, by the way, may be somewhat responsible for that. I handled one of those cases in the trial court way back when.
Justice Scalia, in his opinion in Jardine, said that bringing the police dog onto the porch with the objective of gathering evidence is like a trespass because, he said, and, you know, Scalia is a trespass guy in Fourth Amendment. That's why you got a Sotomayor and others, our privacy view of the Fourth Amendment. And because he says the fact that you can go onto the property, onto the house, and onto the house itself, you're invited, but you're invited as it is to help the person inside the house. You're not invited to go onto the house and be destructive or to gather evidence of a criminal activity. And so to Justice Scalia, the police officer would have known that you're not, that he's in the wrong place using a dog to gather evidence on at the house. How do you answer that?
Today, I would say yes, the police officer should know that. Then, no.
Well, don't you have other cases that the officer can't be at the house with intrusive methods like the infrared cameras, that they can't put it up against the house and gather evidence because that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment? And Scalia winds up the opinion saying that when the government uses a physical intrusion to explore the details of the home, including curtilage, that is a violation of the Fourth because it's a trespass. Now, if you look into the windows yourself, and I'm not sure about the binoculars, but looking at the windows yourself, without any other instruments or tools, that's okay. But you've got Supreme Court cases that say if you use a tool, it isn't okay.
Yes, the Kylo decision certainly was decided at that time. And in a vacuum, were that the only precedent we're dealing with?
No, but that's the problem. Your position is if you have unsettled law, then there's good faith by the police officer, and you don't suppress it. In effect, the Fourth Amendment would become a suppression, would only be used if it was egregious or the motivation of the officer was wrong, using it to gather information against his brother-in-law or something. You know, the motivation was bad. You're really blowing open the good faith.
I don't think I'm blowing open good faith. I mean, again, the point being deterrence. And this is a quote from, I believe, Davis. The exclusionary rules' sole purpose, we have repeatedly held, is to to deter future Fourth Amendment violations. Where suppression fails to yield appreciable deterrence, exclusion is clearly unwarranted. And so, when you have an officer and you cannot say that that officer knew or should have known what the officer was doing was unlawful, and then that officer makes full and appropriate disclosure of everything the officer did, both to a reviewing officer and or a governmental attorney, and then it's submitted to a neutral, detached magistrate, I submit that to exclude the evidence has no appreciable deterrence value, and so the exclusionary rule ought not be applied.
Well, do you want to deter the police officer from pushing the envelope in searches? Do we want to have the police officers err on the side of constitutional rights? I mean, that's the balance here.
The balance, of course, sure. Do we want to violate Fourth Amendment rights? Of course not.
No, but you see,
any more than we want to deter good police work. There is a balance. Of course there is. And I think the standard I've suggested strikes it. Perfectly in compliance with Dearborn and Davis.
Tell us your standard again.
Standard again is this.
Pardon me?
The standard again is this. When officers do not know or should not know that their actions are unlawful, and they then make full and proper disclosure of the extent of their investigation and what they did to a reviewing officer and or governmental attorney, as is required by EASON, and subsequently then submitted to a neutral, detached magistrate who signs off on the warrant and issues it. And then, down the road, United States Supreme Court precedent overrules that the precedent on which perhaps everyone relied.
It's not just a matter of overruling, but you shouldn't. He wouldn't know it's unlawful. Now he knows.
Now, yes.
So what you've set up is the standard for when you apply Eason's good faith exception.
Yeah, I think this fits very well under Eason and Leon. Absolutely.
What about if you don't get a warrant? So you're on the porch with the dog. You don't know, this is before Jardine, you don't know that dog sniff is going to be a search at a home and illegal without a warrant. And so you got the dog and you got the, you're on the porch, you sniff the drugs, and you know that the people inside know the police are there, and you start to hear bathroom toilets flush. Do you need to go to a magistrate, or if you go in on the search, is that enough?
Well, I mean, obviously you're off on a different analysis of exigent circumstances at that point,
well,
whenever they kick in.
But he's in the wrong place. And you can take out that you hear the toilets flushing, but he knows that things are flushable, right?
Yes.
And that per se won't do it, right?
Right.
All right. So, what happens when you don't have the warrant and he just goes in?
Well, does he hear flushing or not?
No flushing.
Okay, no flushing. I think no one questions that the dog sniff is probable cause, right? We're not here about that today. Probable cause. But absent an exception, no, I think he's got to get a warrant.
Got to get a warrant. You're not going to come in on good faith
without
a warrant. I mean, we started good faith with a warrant, right?
Well, there's certainly a preference for warrants, of course.
No, I mean, the good faith cases started where there was a warrant, and the officer relied on the warrant.
Yes.
Therefore, it was good faith.
Yes, and there, of course, there is a warrant in this case.
That's right. And then the good faith was extended to non-warrant situations.
Well, I'm not advocating for that here today.
I know. Today is the key word.
I can't promise anything in the future any more than anyone else can. But, no, I'm not asking for that today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm asking for a very specific standard that I laid out in the context of a warrant that issues. Because, you know, as much as some people like to dismiss, you know, counsel spoke often of well, we don't want police officers making these kinds of analyses. Now we do. We hold them to a certain standard. We hold police officers to know certain very significant things about the law. But it's relevant down the road, too, because then if the officer doesn't know or shouldn't know what he did was wrong, makes full disclosure, and then a magistrate issues a warrant, aren't we under Leon and Eason? Assuming all the procedures are followed, can't that officer reasonably rely on that warrant? I submit that he or she can and should, and that the good faith exception should apply.
Who has the burden in this context? This is suppression. When officers do not know or should not know that actions are unlawful, what's our standard of review? Of course, is de novo. Objective, but who has the burden of showing this in the procedural posture of this case?
Well, the state, of course, has the burden to show that a search and seizure are reasonable, so I suppose it would be the state.
And to what standard is that showing required? Is it clear and convincing, do you know, right offhand?
No, I don't.
Now, why do you need the first part of this? This is a warrant case. What difference? Suppose the police officer says, hey, I really have grave doubts about a dog on the porch. These old cases say dog in the luggage rack, and then the dog in the car. And Gant is a real problem now, and Belton's a problem. So I'm not sure that this is good. In fact, there are no cases in Wisconsin that say I can do this. And then the police officer makes full disclosure to the magistrate and to the government attorney as to what he's done. He doesn't advise them at the law, right? Mm-hmm. The police officer doesn't advise the magistrate about the law.
No.
And doesn't advise the DA about the law.
I would hope not.
Right.
It happens sometimes, but...
We hope that the DA knows the law.
We hope so.
So now there's full disclosure, just as in this case, and the magistrate and the government attorney say, go ahead and issue the warrant. Why isn't then the officer's reliance on the warrant good, and what the police officer thinks about the law irrelevant?
I don't think it's irrelevant. You're talking about clear and settled precedent. We do consider what the law was at the time.
But that's for the magistrate and the DA.
Yes.
What the police officer goes in and tells all the facts, gets the warrant. Why can't they rely on the warrant, even if the police officer thinks that this is not a good search?
Well, we'd certainly hope police officers wouldn't do that if someone sat at a table and said, I think this is a bad search, but let's go ahead and do that.
Well, but he's got the magistrate, who's a neutral law person, right? Trained in the law, got a law degree, licensed to practice in Wisconsin, right?
Yes.
And then he's got the DA or assistant DA, law trained, licensed to practice in Wisconsin. They decide the legal. They issue a warrant, or the magistrate issues a warrant. Why don't we just say it's good enough under the warrant? But why do you insist that the police officer doesn't know or should not know?
I think that's only part of the analysis. And when you get a magistrate who signs off on a warrant, this kind of goes back to the rubber stamp function we don't want magistrates to have, right? We don't want them to just sign off on a warrant. And when a magistrate moves off of his or her neutral and detached stance and approves a warrant in violation of the law, it goes. It should. That's another violation of Leon.
I understand that. But in this case, when the magistrate issued the warrant, should the magistrate have issued this warrant?
Yes.
Because, here's why.
Because at that time, the state of the law was such that had I reviewed this warrant as a prosecuting attorney, I would have approved it as acceptable under the law. Again, Place, Cabalas, Miller, mm-hmm. Arias, mm-hmm. Edgeburg. Mm-hmm. And I think the magistrate did the same thing.
That's right. And what the police officer thought about the law is irrelevant. That's my point.
I don't think it's irrelevant. I mean, at some point, like today, if the officer said, well, you know, I don't know. George leaves this open a little bit. I think it's a little bit unclear. You'll say no to that officer. I mean, you do hold them to a certain standard. Does it dictate the result in every instance? No. But to suggest that we don't ask or want or expect police officers to know the law in many respects, I think, is not the case.
Isn't the standard an objective one? Whether a reasonable police officer in the same or similar circumstances, as opposed to, I guess I'm just not following this line of thought about the subjective thoughts of the officer, and with no diminishment of respect to law enforcement, who cares? And I say that because we don't expect them to be lawyers. We expect them to act as reasonable law enforcement officers. So are you saying there's something less than something different than an objective standard?
No, I agree with you. I think okay. It is an objective standard. The reasonable officer in the position presented, would he or she know?
Or should have known.
He or
and that
she
makes,
know.
Yeah,
yes, but. Absolutely.
When I first started preparing for this case, I took the approach that the chief seems to be asking about. I thought to myself, look, they've got a warrant. Why isn't it just a good faith reliance on a warrant? I mean, why are we nuancing this to get underneath and what happened before, what officers knew or should have known before, and then they go to a DA, and then they, I mean, why isn't this just a they got a warrant and they have good faith reliance on it?
I think in many respects it is.
But that's not the way this case is being argued or presented.
And that's not your standard. Your standard that you want the court to do is to look at what the police officer knew or should have known. Why not just argue a straight Leon? I think it was Leon. You got a warrant. It looks good on its face. You can... Do you rely on all of the material in the affidavit other than the dog sniff? Is that sufficient to support the warrant or not?
In the absence of the dog sniff?
In the absence of the dog sniff.
No.
Why not?
I don't think they have probable cause to go in the house on that. I agree with counsel on that point. The CI, while reliable, doesn't get them in the house.
It doesn't give them a good warrant.
No, absent the dog sniff, it didn't.
Okay, so you need the dog sniff for the warrant.
Yes.
And we can at least agree that it is not clear, unsettled law in Wisconsin that a dog sniff at the house is not okay or is okay. It's just not clear, settled law in Wisconsin on that.
Was there a case specifically on all fours? No, it's not bowling, okay. As I said. But I think we're close.
Okay. So, therefore, if you're close, the warrant looks good. The warrant looks as if, and as you said, if you were the DA here, you would have said it's under the state of the law acceptable. Doesn't mean you had to have a case on all fours, right?
Right.
So, the warrant looks good. And the people who execute the warrant can rely on the warrant, which looks good on its face, at least as to the sniff part. Doesn't look so good on the other part. But you can excise that if I understand the status of the law. So it's a straight, good faith warrant case. Why extend this to the cop, to the police officer, and what the police officer knew?
Well, perhaps I strayed too far afield, and again, I reading Davis and particularly Justice Sotomayor's concurrence, I figured that would be a concern for this court. It is for me. It is slightly different here, isn't it? But I agree with you. This case very much can be and should be decided based on Leon and Eason, and I think
because if you don't, applies. You have to then change the language in Dearborn, right? Mm-hmm. Which talks about relying on clear, settled law. Right? Dearborn is a very limited case.
Yes, it is.
It's not on all fours with this.
No.
But the federal cases that look at the circumstances we have here, where there isn't an on
all fours rule, do look through and examine what the police officer knew or should have done.
Absolutely. The police officer's conduct, misconduct, understanding of the law, or violation thereof is not irrelevant. And I think Justice Sotomayor pointed that out in her concurrence as well. It's not, we don't, it's, you don't throw it out. It very much is a theme throughout the analysis.
It's a part of the mix. And all the lower federal cases that I read all look at what the officer knew or should have known at the
Absolutely.
Time of the search.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Do you know the date of the search?
I believe the warrant was issued in July of 2010, and the petition in Jardines was filed in October of 2011. I don't know if that was going to be your question, but I thought I'd go there.
You know when the Florida Supreme Court issued its opinion?
In Jardines?
Yeah.
The decision is made March 26th of 2013.
No, that's the U.S. Supreme Court decision.
It says that the Florida Supreme Court was 73 Southern 2nd 34, dated 2011.
Okay.
And I don't have the particular month.
I'm looking at the Jardines headnote or synopsis in the beginning. Florida Supreme Court is 73 South 3rd, 34.
Right. That's
Florida District Court of Appeals, 9 South 3rd, 1. And you say the search was in July 2010?
Yes.
And the Florida Supreme Court was in March 2011?
I believe Justice Abrahamson said so. I'm
11, I don't know the March.
That's probably right.
And the Florida Supreme Court reversed the District Court of Appeals then in March 2011.
It did.
So at the time of the search, the Court of Appeals decision in Florida would have been different law.
And Florida was very much an outlier in making that decision. And more important, the law in Wisconsin was still Miller and Arias and from the United States Supreme
Court. What I'm saying is that the Court of Appeals in Florida would have been consistent with your position at that time.
Oh, I see. That may be.
So, if the magistrate had gone online and saw what the law was, perhaps Florida versus Jardines would have come up.
Perhaps.
Or State versus Jardines in the Florida Court of Appeals.
Perhaps.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Loeb.
I don't think there's any way Dearborn or United States versus Davis applies because Dearborn, in my opinion, has a very specific holding in that the officers have to be relying on binding appellate precedent at the time of the search. And the United States versus Davis case, in that case, the defendant conceded that the police officers' search at the time they did the search complied with then-binding law. So I don't think this case at all can be decided on the lines of Dearborn or United States versus Davis.
Jardine didn't send this back. The U.S. Supreme Court didn't send this back
Correct.
To the Florida court to find good faith.
They didn't discuss good faith at all. They suppressed the evidence.
They suppressed the evidence,
they
period.
Did. So and I think the Court of Appeals here should have done the same thing.
Did you
thing.
Check the Florida Supreme Court case?
I did not, no.
Okay.
The state wants to rely on Leon and Eason. My position there is that both of those cases have to do with errors of magistrates, not errors of the police. Regardless of what the police officers knew the law to be or should have known the law to be, the police did something wrong in this case. That's clear. That can't be disputed, in my opinion. Leon and Eason don't involve situations where the police did anything wrong. The police were reasonable in those two cases because they were relying on a warrant that a magistrate issued that after the fact a magistrate should not have issued. So you can't blame the police for that. You're not going to deter the police for excluding any evidence that resulted from an illegal search when they're merely following the legal opinion of the magistrate who issued the warrant.
But somebody gave the magistrate an affidavit.
Of solid, not tainted evidence. In this situation, part of the evidence to support the search warrant was illegally obtained evidence from the dogs. That's the other main difference with the Leon case and the Eason case. It's a magistrate fault there. We're not going to blame the police for a magistrate's fault. And the evidence presented to the magistrate in Leon and Eason was lawfully obtained evidence by the police as part of their investigation. The evidence in this case was illegally obtained evidence of the dog sniff that was part of the warrant application process. And as the state has conceded, there wouldn't have been a warrant without the evidence of the dog sniff because the confidential informant did not connect drugs to Skull's home, only connected drugs to his vehicle. So my opinion is Dearborn is out because there's no binding appellate precedent saying you're allowed to bring a drug-sniffing dog to the front porch of an individual's house without a warrant. Along the same lines, United States versus Davis holds the same thing. Leon and Eason don't apply because both of those cases involve magistrate error, not police error. Both of those cases involve evidence that was not later ruled illegal as part of the application for the search warrant. In Skull's case, it's the police officer's mistake, error, conduct, whatever you want to label it, that caused the Fourth Amendment violation. And in Skull's case, the part of the facts that led to the issuance of the search warrant was evidence that was obtained illegally.
Well, counsel, at the risk of asking the obvious, once the officers took the application to the magistrate here, and the magistrate reviewed it and gave lawful authority for the search, wasn't it transformed into the magistrate's error, if there was error here?
No, because it's not a probable cause or reasonable suspicion error.
Because what?
It's not a probable cause issue or reasonable suspicion issue. The magistrate's not going to look at the legality of the officer's conduct in obtaining the evidence that's part of the search warrant.
So the magistrate defers his judgment on what is lawful to the police? That's your view?
My view is that the magistrate simply reviews a search warrant affidavit for probable cause, and if it's
your
probable
view,
cause,
do you have anything to support that?
That's my opinion as to what occurred.
Doesn't that seem to kind of put the cart before the horse? I mean, you go to a judge's house at night as a trial court judge, and there are four of us on this bench who served at the trial court, not unfamiliar with having law enforcement come to our homes at odd hours, and your view is that the officer's understanding of what the law is trumps the magistrate's, and the magistrate is solely there to look at the factors to decide whether it's more probable than not that there's contraband or crime afoot or evidence of criminal activity.
Right. And my feeling is that because of the time constraints associated with that, because it's not an adversarial process, and because generally the police are in a hurry to get these things approved, that analysis did not take place in this case and doesn't take place in a lot of the cases.
So in your view, the magistrate or the judge, we include judge within magistrate.
Yes.
The magistrate is not to look at the conduct that law enforcement used to gather the evidence to prepare the application. The magistrate is solely to determine probable cause.
Yes, I don't think a magistrate is looking at the legality of an underlying search. I don't think they have the time to do it, and I don't think it's part of what their review of the search warrant affidavit.
But yet you have no authority for that proposition.
No, that's my opinion.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
I think not.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Loeb? that concludes our third argument today. I don't think we have a month goes by where we don't deal with the Fourth Amendment. I just read a piece that's true of the U.S. Supreme Court, too, that the Fourth Amendment is standard fare in appellate courts, and always with a new twist, as is this. That concludes our argument in 2011 AP 2956 CR, State v. Skull, and I want to thank both counsel for their briefs and their oral argument. We are in recess until our next oral argument. We'll have three more cases.